from the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to the 142nd episode of Deconstructing Dinner, produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. As promised, for the first half of today's episode, we'll continue with our ongoing Norway-British Columbia series, a series that is looking deep into the controversial salmon farming industry off the western coast of Canada. While the vast majority of the product is shipped into the United States, the known and unknown impacts of these farms on the Canadian marine ecosystem have attracted many concerned conservation groups to place this industry clearly on their radar. On this part 5 of the series, we speak with the Living Oceans Society's Shauna McKinnon, a markets campaigner for the organization based in Vancouver, who has been closely monitoring the emergence of organic salmon, a rather perplexing concept that we'll learn more about on today's broadcast. And in the second half of the show, part 6 of our ongoing series on the cooperative model as an alternative to the industrial food system. This edition will feature a production produced by New York City's Christine Black, titled "We'll Work for Food, the Park Slope Food Co-op." The co-op is one of the last remaining member-run food cooperatives in the United States, and Christine's half-hour production appeared on Pacifica Radio's weekly radio show, Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots. The presence of open-net cage salmon farms is an ongoing and contentious debate, not only off the coast of British Columbia, but around the world where such farms exist. Norway, Chile, Scotland, and Canada are some of the most notable locations for these controversial operations. And by all accounts, these farms are industrial factory farms, with many of the sites in Canada being home to 500,000 fish in a surface area no larger than a football field. The farms interact directly with the marine environment, raising concerns over their concentrated accumulations of waste, disease and parasite transfer between the cultured and wild fish, animal welfare concerns, and the list goes on. And so when salmon eaters around the world are slowly being introduced to salmon labeled as organic, we certainly need to inquire into what exactly that means. Salmon, after all, are most commonly recognized as a wild food, and is wild food not as organic as any? Sharing her thoughts on the subject with Deconstructing Dinner is Shauna McKinnon, a markets campaigner with the Living Oceans Society, Canada's largest organization focusing exclusively on marine conservation issues. Based in Sointula, a small fishing village on the central coast of British Columbia, the society was started in 1998 and has long been a vocal critic of open net cage salmon farms. Shauna spoke to us from Vancouver.
Well, when you see an organic labeled salmon in the grocery store in the U.S. or in Canada, you're not actually seeing a product that's been certified to North American organic standards. Right now, the only organic certification for salmon is actually from European certifiers. But in fact, the rules around organic certification in Europe allow for the use of antibiotics and pesticides to treat livestock. So salmon is no exception. So most of the organic farm salmon products that you see on the shelves, these fish are grown in net cages the same way that the industry in BC is growing them. And because they're grown in net cages, they're exposed to disease and parasites. And those are continue to be persistent problems on those farms. So the animals, if they do become infected with sea lice or with any type of disease, these organic farms are still able to treat them with the same chemicals that are used in the production, in regular conventional production here. So when you see an organic farm salmon product, you're not actually seeing a product that's much different than the run-of-the-mill, industrial, conventional farm salmon that's causing problems right in our own backyard. So that's something that is a surprise to many consumers. Also, many of the businesses that are selling this product are selling it because they think it's better, but it's really just not the case.
With no certified organic salmon being produced in North America, Shauna shares how prevalent organic labeled salmon is on grocery store shelves and restaurant menus.
It definitely is out there. It's hard to track what the prevalence is because it isn't tracked by importer expert statistics, but I definitely know that it's being sold in a lot of specialty fish shops, and many restaurants are also starting to use it in their supply as well. Probably not so much on the West Coast in the Pacific Northwest, but definitely it's being used in California and Ontario, so it's quite prevalent.
In British Columbia, where controversy with the salmon farming sector has been widespread, an association of industry groups has been working diligently to create a certified organic standard for farm salmon. Throughout the 8 years of those efforts, the Living Oceans Society has been actively involved.
There are not standards for organic aquaculture in North America yet, but there has been a push to develop them. So in British Columbia, the push for organic certification of salmon has really been an 8-year ongoing push from industry players to get organic certification. And it's been unsuccessful in BC up until this year when the national program for organics will be put into place. Organic certification has been regulated at the provincial level. So BC salmon farmers were attempting to get organic standards for salmon, but they had to work through the provincial organic standards body. And they opened up the question to a lot of public input, a lot of scientific input. And, you know, after a protracted debate that has taken place over 8 years, they still were not successful in coming to a set of standards that everyone could feel comfortable with passing. And what it had taken was for the board members to agree that these standards were strong enough that they wouldn't be negatively impacting the broader standards. So it was really important for them to make sure that any organic aquaculture standards would be on the same level of certified organic livestock standards for terrestrial production. So that has been a debate that Living Ocean Society has been involved in.
The Certified Organic Associations of BC, the COABC, is no longer involved in determining whether a standard for farm salmon should exist. And Shauna further explains why and who is now involved in moving these efforts forward.
Well, what actually happened was the BC certifying organic body, the board members decided about a year or two ago that they didn't want to go any further in this process, that, you know, that they'd spent so much time discussing this and were not able to come to an adequate set of standards, that they decided to stop working on it. And at that point, the BC Ministry of Agriculture and Lands, which is also responsible for promoting aquaculture, decided to get involved, and they tried to keep on with this push. They were also unsuccessful in completing that. So now it will have to go through a national process, similar to what the National Organic Standards for Food and Crop Production had to go through. But the agency, the government agency that's now pushing for the standards is actually the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. And they've been working with industry and actually supporting financially the development of industry standards, which will then go to the national standard setting process.
The Living Ocean Society has also been involved in the United States, submitting their comments on the development of an organic standard for farm salmon underway there. In November 2008, Shauna co-authored a letter to the National Organic Standards Board in the U.S., sharing their concerns.
We've also been involved in the U.S. The National Organic Standards Board in the U.S. has been working on organic aquaculture standards, and they're actually further along than we are in Canada. They have a draft set of standards that the board members have put forward. But in those standards, clearly stated and clearly designed the standards to ensure that net cage salmon production, like what we have here in the Pacific Northwest, that's causing so much harm to wild salmon, cannot be certified as organic. And we have worked with our allies in the U.S. as well and helping to get more public involvement from Canada and the U.S. in putting information into that process to make sure that a high bar of standards was put in place.
Back here in Canada, and as introduced earlier, for about a year now, the Federal Department of Fisheries and Oceans, the DFO, has been working with industry to assist them in moving towards the creation of a national standard. However, the DFO is not the body that would set the standard. That would instead end up in the hands of the Canadian General Standards Board. And so it remains to be seen whether the Standards Board will too encounter the challenges faced by British Columbia's certifying body, the COABC. We asked Shauna what the primary challenges were for the COABC that led them to give up on the decision-making process.
There definitely were a few issues, and the same type of issues that have come up in the U.S. as well. One of the issues is the fact that wild salmon are migratory species. The average salmon travels over 1,000 kilometers in its lifetime. So confining that type of migratory species to a small pen, it's really difficult to make the argument that it's being raised in a way that's natural to its behavior. So that was a really huge stumbling point for the COABC. In the U.S., the National Organic Science Board was not so concerned with that, but their concerns focus more heavily on the impacts to wild salmon for sea lice and the spread of disease, and just the inability of net cages to control disease and to prevent the spread to wild fish. And the other element that's been a huge issue is the use of wild fish in feed. So while this is quite a confusing point, I think, for consumers and for the public, wild fish cannot be considered organic because they are free-ranging and you can't control the diet that they're eating. So organic standards are all about being able to control the inputs and the outputs of the production system. So wild fish themselves could never be considered organic. But then that raises the question of how do you consider a farm fish that's eating wild fish as a main part of its diet to be organic? And so that was a big stumbling block in BC.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, and part 5 of our Norway-British Columbia series, a series exploring the controversial salmon farming industry off the western coast of Canada. We're hearing from Shauna McKinnon, a markets campaigner with the Living Oceans Society, a vocal critic of the sector. Shauna has introduced a number of concerns as to why the society believes the public should be wary of salmon labeled as organic, and why certifying bodies have found it so difficult to agree upon standards for a certified organic sector that is trying to develop itself here in North America. Certainly, the feed fed to the farm salmon is a critical piece of this organic salmon equation, and Shauna expands on the notion of feeding wild fish to farm salmon and then calling it organic.
I mean, the use of forage fish and the need to have more wild fish being eaten by farm salmon or other types of farm fish that are high trophic level than you can actually produce is a huge cause for concern, because from a sustainability perspective, if you have a type of production that's actually using more protein than it's producing, it's very difficult to argue that that could be sustainable or something that is not causing an environmental impact, which is one of the main goals of organic production. So that is a definite issue that cannot be addressed by current production standards. So in the U.S., the standards that they decide to go with demand at least a one-to-one fish in to fish out standard. So that's something that Living Ocean Society supports as a baseline. And if farm salmon is to be included in any kind of Canadian standard, then they would not be able to meet that at the moment. So we would hope that that would be a baseline bar for what we talk about as sustainable or organic aquaculture.
Perhaps the most well-known of concerns facing the industry as a whole are sea lice and the unnatural incubation of this parasite on the farms and the risks that they pose to wild juvenile salmon passing by the farms. We asked Shauna McKinnon if sea lice risks to the passing wild salmon would be any different in a proposed organic system.
Well, for the proposed standards in the U.S., one of the restrictions that they put was net cages could not be used in areas where there could be impacts on wild fish migration or reproduction. So in an area like BC, where we have a significant body of scientific evidence showing that there are impacts from these farms on wild fish, this would be an area where they would not be able to operate. In Canada, I would hope that we would have the same type of standards, but my concern is that because the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, who are part of their portfolio is to be protecting wild fish, but they are also actively promoting aquaculture. And the fact that they are financing industry to develop these standards, the concern is that, you know, they would obviously want to operate on both coasts where we have information that sea lice from these salmon farms are impacting wild fish.
Now, one of the groups making themselves heard and encouraging the emergence of certified organic salmon is the BC Salmon Farmers Association, the BCSFA, the trade group representing British Columbia's salmon farming industry. In late 2008, the BCSFA published a comment on their website in support of creating a standard for organic salmon. The commentary sought to compare the existence of organic standards on land to those that they would like to see exist in the marine environment. One paragraph in particular reads this: "Land farms are open to the environment, wild animals, animal and airborne pests and diseases in exactly the same way as aquatic farms. The risk of disease and parasite transfer is real in both cases. Whether this risk can be managed in a manner conducive to organic certification on ocean farms should be judged in accordance with the impact of land-based farms on terrestrial wildlife." End quote. The Living Ocean Society's Shauna McKinnon responds:
"This quote really, I think, is a falsehood, that the Salmon Farming Association has definitely tried to perpetuate this myth that there's no difference farming in the water than farming on land. But it's absolutely a completely different situation. Just to give one example with sea lice, the impact of sea lice in a net cage farm, from one farm and the amount of sea lice that's produced on that farm, because the farm salmon are in close proximity to each other, sea lice numbers breed very quickly. And even with a fairly low level of sea lice per farm fish, when you have 500,000 salmon in a farm, that quickly becomes a huge number of sea lice. And we've seen through scientific research that the impact of that farm, the sea lice cloud, so to speak, is up to 70 kilometers away. So the impact of each one of those farms, or the footprint of each one of those farms, is huge and is impacting wild fish for many, many kilometers. And on land, we just don't have the same type of dynamic of having farmed and wild species of the same type in close proximity transferring disease and parasites. And if you look at the biosecurity measures that are demanded of on-land intensive livestock operations, those are just not at all, not even close to what's being followed in the water for these net cage farms. So it's no surprise, really, that we do have these massive problems with net cage farm salmon, because there is no biosecurity measures to separate or control disease and parasites passing between the wild and farmed. So the Salmon Farmers Association and this assertion that it is the same is just a falsehood. And to try and make this comparison between, well, you know, there could be organic or better management using a net cage system, it's untrue, because organic management really depends on being able to have control of what's being inputted and outputted from a farm system. And without that control, it can't work.
Shauna McKinnon. As mentioned earlier, the efforts to introduce an organic standard for farm salmon in Canada has been led by industry players. Certainly the BC Salmon Farmers Association is one of those players, but the most active, though, is a group calling itself the Pacific Organic Seafood Association, POSA. One of the association's founding members and the only producing any notable production of finished product is Creative Salmon, located off the western coast of Vancouver Island near the community of Tofino. Creative Salmon happens to be one of only a few Canadian-owned companies. Another very active member of the association is Taplow Feeds. Shauna McKinnon shares her thoughts on the activities of POSA.
Well, POSA is the Pacific Organic Seafood Association. They're based here in BC, and it's a number of industry groups that are interested in organic certification. So these businesses would like to see organic certification for the products so they can receive a premium for their products. And from our perspective, their motivations are quite clear for why they would like to see organic certification. They feel like if they do things a little bit differently, they can have this organic brand, which would be very powerful for them in the marketplace.
Now, Canadian-owned Creative Salmon has for a number of years been seeking to operate their farm sites following the organic standards that POSA is proposing become the certified standards. For Creative Salmon, however, this has not been an easy process. And to learn more about the company's efforts, Deconstructing Dinner had scheduled an interview with Creative Salmon, but their general manager canceled the interview the day before the scheduled time. No reason was given as to why. But there's quite a lot of information about Creative Salmon out there. The company has been in the middle of a number of incidents that don't seem to bode well for their organic intentions, and certainly would not be of help to any salmon farm business, regardless of the label on the final product. In 2000, as an example, a mass grave of more than 15 sea lions was found in Tofino Inlet. The sea lions were confirmed to have been shot by employees at the Creative Salmon Farms. Fish farms often obtain a license to dispatch marine mammals that threaten the fish in their net pens. Creative has been cited numerous times for non-compliance with regulations. In 2003, the BC Ministry of Water, Land, and Air Protection cited Creative Salmon with non-compliance violations at three of its four active farms. In Clackwood Sound, the infractions included disposal of net waste, fuel storage and containment, and site registration. And also in 2003, BC Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Fisheries cited Creative with non-compliance violations of site configuration and or biomass at three of its farms. In 2002, the same government agency reported 9 cases of non-compliance at Creative's farms, including a failure to report escapes at its Eagle Bay site. In 2005, Fish from Creative Salmon sites tested positive for the presence of malachite green, a known carcinogen that can be used as a fungicide in the raising of farm salmon. With malachite green not being permitted for food production in Canada, the incident did not go unnoticed by the public and conservation groups. The company maintained that they had never used the product, and the issue has since passed. But then in late 2007, the United States Federal Drug Administration, the FDA, performed a random test of Creative Salmon's fish as they passed across the border, and those two tested positive for traces of malachite green. The company continued to maintain that they had never used malachite green. Creative Salmon has also been involved in a lengthy and ongoing legal battle after taking a well-known opponent of open net cage salmon farms to court in a defamation suit. Challenges continued into the first months of 2007, when 110 sea lions died at Creative Salmon's farms, including 51 California sea lions found entangled in the nets and drowned at one of their farm sites into Fino Inlet. The company's feed supplier, Taplow Feeds, has also run into difficulties both in 2007 and 2008 in accessing certified organic wheat for their feed, and have instead resorted to conventional wheat on both of those occasions. Also in 2008, the company found trace levels of the antibiotic fluorphenicol in their fish, which under normal organic food standards would not be permitted. And perhaps it was these, among other concerns, that led the general manager of Creative Salmon, Spencer Evans, to leave the company in 2008. One of the most telling comments we came across made by Evans was in an interview for the magazine BC Business, in which he declared that the goal to achieve organic status is, quote, toast. Evans believes that conservation groups have forced the proposed standards to be so high that open net cage salmon farms would not be able to attain such standards. Creative Salmon nevertheless continues to promote itself as working to become certified organic. Here again is the Living Ocean Society's Shauna McKinnon, sharing her thoughts on Creative Salmon and some of the other players either seeking to produce certified organic salmon or who already are.
Creative Salmon, one way that they do differ from the other companies operating in BC is that they are producing Chinook salmon. So it is a Pacific salmon species. The benefits of this is that they seem to be more resistant to sea lice infection, which would be a positive. But in fact, Creative Salmon has been doing monitoring on their farms for sea lice, but they have not shared that data publicly. And they're also operating in the Tofino Biosphere Reserve. So the Biosphere Reserve Committee has actually been requesting to have this sea lice data, but they've been unwilling to share it. And I think that just sort of gives an example of the resistance to public scrutiny of the farms and to sharing with their neighbors and other people that have a vested interest in protection of the local area. For other companies involved, Yellow Island Aquaculture is also a member of POSA, and they really are a very, very tiny operation that's sort of just experimenting with ways of producing salmon and are not a major producer. And I think they got involved with the idea of this promotion of organics as a way of trying to find maybe a better way of producing this product. But I don't know that they're actually actively pursuing this anymore. And I really think at this point it's Creative Salmon and Tatlow Foods. But I think also, even though POSA has sort of been the main champion of organics so far in BC, the biggest producer in BC, which is Marine Harvest, they have organic certified farms in Ireland, which are basically using exactly the same kind of production that they're using here in BC. So one of the concerns is that with organic certified standards, if the bar is set low, then all of the production here could go for organic certification.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. Now, the Pacific Organic Seafood Association drafted a set of standards in 2004 that they have posted on their website. POSA did not respond to our email invitation to appear on the show, and no phone number is listed on the site. But of interest in their standards is the section on animal welfare, which would require a certified organic salmon farm to, quote, meet the salmon's physiological and behavioral needs. Now, with salmon, as mentioned earlier, being a nomadic species that travel thousands of miles as part of their annual migration, it really doesn't appear that any salmon farmer would ever be able to come close to being certified organic, so long as the fish are in cages. And perhaps the objectives of this push to create organic standards are made even more questionable upon coming across a section of Creative Salmon's website under the heading Organic. This page summarizes some of the ways that the company operates using what they call organic principles, with one heading reading animal welfare. Listed there are the five freedoms, a standard for animal welfare that has existed for decades and is used around the world as a benchmark. The five freedoms consist of freedom from thirst and hunger, freedom from discomfort, freedom from pain, injury, and disease, freedom from fear and distress, and freedom to express normal behavior. Yet upon closer look at Creative Salmon's list of five freedoms, it appears that the company has conveniently changed one of the freedoms to suit their own needs. Instead of freedom to express normal behavior, Creative Salmon has changed it to read freedom from unnecessary restriction on behavior. Seemingly a way for the company to argue that keeping salmon in cages is, quote, necessary. Another questionable standard proposed on the POSA website are, quote, social objectives, under which reads, the encouragement of the use of local resources and services. The Living Ocean Society's Shauna McKinnon responds to this objective.
The one thing that's very interesting about that objective is that in Canada, it's actually not legal to use forage fish as feed for farmed fish. So one of the products that's being used in farmed salmon feed is herring. And herring is caught for roe in BC, and so that's just for the eggs. And then the rest of the herring, the entire fish, is considered a waste byproduct. So they're able to incorporate that into feed. But the reason why we have this regulation in Canada is to prevent the fishing of one type of fish to be fed to a higher trophic one, which is not as efficient of a use of the wild fish. So it's quite funny, actually, that they would include this as an objective to use local resources. But one of the local resources that they're using, they're actually using in a way that is counter to the regulations that exist. And just, you know, really in general, if you're looking at an organic farm system, what you're ultimately looking for is a system that can use as many things on site within the farm system and reducing the amount of off-farm inputs that you need to bring in. And wild fish are ultimate users of local resources. They do all the work for you. So one might ask the question, why would we be trying to raise a farm fish in a way which could never be more efficient than what wild fish are doing? There definitely is a role for sustainable aquaculture in meeting our food needs, but when it comes to farming salmon, I think wild salmon have us beat.
And that was Shauna McKinnon, a markets campaigner working with the Living Ocean Society in Vancouver. In closing out this part 5 of our Norway-British Columbia series here on Deconstructing Dinner, we'll leave you with some final thoughts from Shauna before we move into the second half of today's show in part 6 of our ongoing series on cooperatives as an alternative to our industrial food system.
As I mentioned earlier, Fisheries and Oceans Canada is now helping industry develop organic standards for aquaculture that would be taken nationally. And this is a new development, and they're actually still doing this behind closed doors. And very soon, it will have to become a public process. And so I would encourage everybody that cares about organic food and the sustainability of both our land-based food system and our marine ecosystems to actively get involved when that becomes a public process, because it's very, very important, not just for protecting wild salmon, but also for protecting the integrity of the organic food system and what organic farmers in Canada have been working for decades to build. So you can keep following this issue on the livingoceansociety.org website, or also the farmedanddangerous.org website, which is the website of the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I'm John Steinman. Today's broadcast is, as usual, archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. In this second half of today's broadcast, we revisit with our ongoing series that has been exploring the cooperative model as an alternative to the industrial food system. This part 6 of the series will feature a production by New York City's Christine Black, who produced the following segment for Sprouts, a weekly half-hour radio show distributed by Pacifica Radio. With Deconstructing Dinner having just produced the most recent episode of Sprouts, we thought it would be nice to share another production for Sprouts on our show, and this one being first broadcast in November 2008.
Welcome to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program that showcases stories from this and many other community stations across the country. We bring you local stories of national interest. I'm Christine Black at Pacifica Radio in New York City. This week, we bring you a story about building a community around food. The Park Slope Food Co-op in Brooklyn, New York, has been around since 1973. It's a successful business that makes no profit. Its goal is sustainability, good food, and cheap prices through shared labor. Today, the Park Slope Food Co-op has almost 15,000 members, and it's still growing.
So now that we're going through a recession, you have more people coming in joining the co-op.
I'm on a fixed income, so therefore, this is really a boon for me.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
And the prices are fantastic. Cynthia McKnight, a working mother, was shopping for energy bars.
Oh, man, I couldn't afford eating healthy food if I wasn't a member of the co-op. Because when I priced it, even though the co-op is modest when they say you save like only 30%, I see it more as, you know, 50, 70% sometimes. I think even if I was rich, I would still be a member.
When you think of health food, organic produce, food without preservatives or artificial colors, food that's environmentally responsible, unconventionally grown, it must be expensive, right? That's where the Park Slope Food Co-op is different.
Smell this basil. This was harvested
yesterday
evening. And for New York City, that's pretty good.
As the season goes on, we stress local. We go out of our way to buy local. We make a real difference in several farmers' lives.
We have white cucumbers, lemon cucumbers, round, spiky cucumbers, just whatever farmers feel like growing in the effort to support biodiversity.
It's the only co-op of its type that requires work from its members. So you have an understanding that the person who's checking out your food is a member just like you, doing their work slot.
Don't call them volunteers. Every member of this co-op works 2 3/4 of an hour every 4 weeks. No work, no shopping.
Oh, I appreciate the structure. I appreciate the discipline.
And a lot of energy is put into making sure only workers shop. From the check-in at the front door to running their membership card at checkout, member labor keeps prices low. So what is a cooperative? A cooperative is a business model where members pool resources. Some co-ops are made up of people who sell things. The Park Slope Food Co-op is a buyer's cooperative. It's owned by the shoppers.
The co-op world is a great world.
Joe Holtz is one of the co-op's general coordinators.
Credit unions are co-ops, and there are some insurance companies that are co-ops, and I just think the whole business model is a much more progressive, much more democratic model. It's not just about how can I maximize profits. It's more how can I serve real people with real needs.
Cooperatives are also democratically controlled by their members. The membership is voluntary and open to all, and members make a financial investment in the co-op. Ellen Weinstadt.
As an economic model, I would love to see more of this. We're here to help ourselves. Yeah. And it's more than just a food store. It's really a community.
The Park Slope Food Co-op was started in the early 1970s, but the 10 founders had a little bit of an attitude.
We weren't listening to what the society was telling us.
Joe Holtz.
We didn't like the politics. We didn't like the war. We didn't like the imperialism. We didn't like the racism, the sexism, etc. So we also didn't like the food. What is this food? And is it good for us? No. It's like, look at the ingredients of that. It's all these chemicals.
The founders were inspired by Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, which talked about the negative effects of pesticides on birds and humans. They were also reading Frances Moore LePay's book, Diet for a Small Planet, which emphasized a vegetarian lifestyle. There were two main beliefs that all the founders shared. Joe Holtz.
One was that we wanted to have really good food become more affordable, that it could really be an improvement in people's lives if they could eat better.
They also believed cooperation meant working together.
We decided that there was too much of people pulling to become their own individual success and not enough of people really truly working together for a common goal that would benefit the whole community. And it turns out that if you do the cooperation thing right, meaning if you ask everybody to put some work in, then you need to hire fewer people. And the biggest expense of the grocery business is payroll. And so if you have less payroll, then the food could be a lot less expensive. And you're meeting both goals at the same time.
The Park Slope Food Co-op did go through some changes along the way.
They tried letting everybody write up their own bill and discovered that you didn't collect quite enough money that way somehow.
General Coordinator Mike Aiken.
Then they discovered that you needed to have all the members of a household work and not just have one person buying for everybody.
This is around the time when other co-ops probably were deciding, it doesn't work. Let's get rid of the member labor system. But at that point, we said, why are we doing this? Oh, yeah, we're doing it because we believe cooperation means working together. So we're going to figure this out.
Fortunately, a computer came along at about the right time. Basically, that let the co-op enforce that if you hadn't done your work, you couldn't shop. And that was kind of the key to success.
And we needed to create groups of people that work together consistently so that there'd be some kind of social glue. There would be some kind of commitment. Oh, it's those people, the people I know that I didn't show up at Saturday at 8 o'clock or Thursday at noon to help receive a delivery, then they're going to have to lift more stuff up the stairs. Remember, we were upstairs. Celery did really weigh 60 pounds. So,
Joe Holtz grew up in New York, and when the co-op started, he was 22 and working part-time as an assistant teacher in a daycare center.
I had dropped out of college after 2 years because I thought I had more important things to accomplish, including protesting against the Vietnam War and protesting against imperialism with my friends. And we would go to a lot of demonstrations and we would go to meetings, and that was the main theme of our lives.
Back then in the early 70s, a person could live in Park Slope and work part-time. Today, this neighborhood is gentrified and one of the more expensive in New York City. When the co-op started, they had no employees, but around 1975, they decided to hire one person, part-time. They chose the youngest founding member, Joe Holtz.
But I also had very good math skills, and as a kid, I tried to figure out how, when people sold things, how they stayed in business, and I would ask my father questions.
But Joe's values made him an unlikely candidate to run a business.
But I hated what the business world was doing, because the business world was the one who supported the terrible foreign policy. So clearly business as usual was totally unacceptable to me. So business as unusual was what would be acceptable to me. So this is a great opportunity. I got to run a business whose purpose was to make it easier for people to afford to eat better.
The Park Slope Food Co-op may look like a grocery store, but the experience of shopping there is a lot more interactive. From the time you enter the store and drop off your kids at childcare to scanning your membership card at the front desk, the experience here is anything but typical.
I don't want to shop anymore in a grocery store where I don't feel like I'm an owner, where I don't feel like I'm part of it. It's kind of like walking into somebody's strange kitchen.
Do you know if these are organic?
I could take you on a little tour of some of the things that were delivered today, like peas in the pod, sugar snap peas, and snow peas, all from New York State.
In the beginning, Joe and his co-founders were vegetarians, so the produce section takes up one quarter of the store.
My name is Alan Zimmerman. I'm the produce buyer. I don't like to say I'm important, but I have an important job. My job especially, probably possibly more than anyone else's here, is more fun. I get to buy about 250 produce items a week, over 5,000 cases, mostly in season from local farms. But how many people have eaten really gorgeous peaches and spit out something that tasted like an old potato? We go for flavor, we taste things on the way in, and that's how you should buy. If you came in while the watermelons were coming in, you'll see that we cut them open and eat them. We're going to spit it out and send all the watermelons back if they don't taste good.
In terms of our produce and other products, we have a preference for organic when it's available.
Ellen Weinstadt.
If the organic is hugely more expensive than the conventionally grown, we offer our members a choice because not everyone can afford to spend a huge amount of money on organic.
The shopping area looks familiar. Shopping carts, people handing out samples, aisles of produce, bulk items, the dairy case, aisles of packaged food for human and pet, frozen food too, fresh flowers, sushi, an extensive selection of cheeses and beer from around the world.
Paging the office, do you know if we have liquid colloidal minerals?
This is one thing that doesn't happen in a typical grocery store. Ellen Weinstadt.
You hear pages over the loudspeaker all the time. Do we have any of this? Do we have any of that? Do we have any of this in the basement? You know, it's we. It's not they, it's not you, it's we, it's us.
Yes, we should have some with the wellness brand.
So what kind of people do shop at the co-op?
The culture is mixed. We have people who are sort of like diehard vegans and animal rights activists and raw food people who are all concerned about health. We've got foodies that, you know, are yuppies that just love the food itself. We've got people on a budget who are just looking for, I think, a good, affordable source of food.
Today, the Park Slope Food Co-op isn't just for vegetarians. They do carry meat, or the socially and environmentally conscious. It isn't just for people in Park Slope, either. The prices and quality draw people of all ages and all socioeconomic backgrounds. People come in from a few neighborhoods over, or even Connecticut and New Jersey, to do their work slot and their shopping.
You see your neighbors, you see your friends. There's a lot of, hi, how are you, how are you doing here, that may not happen in a regular supermarket.
There was a time when I actually saw a Hasidic woman sharing recipes with a Rastafarian, and it was such a sight to see these two people are, really? Yeah, really? Well, the Jamaican go, well, you know, you have to try a little bit, so, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And really, I have to try that.
But there's still a question.
How do you run an institution that has thousands of members who only work once every 4 weeks, you know, who really can't get expert at anything? And I think it's a miracle this place works at all.
My name is Ellen Weinstadt. I've been working at the Park Slope Food Co-op for 20 years. And I'm an office coordinator. I help coordinate this co-op of close to 14,000 members. Each one of the 14,000 members, if they're not on disability or parental leave, does a work slot. So that's a lot of coordination.
Back in the basement, do you need any more assistance?
The checkout workers are members. Much of the bookkeeping is done by members. Stocking the shelves is done by members.
Please call me at 250.
My name is Jim. I'm the squad leader down here in food processing. And what that basically means is that it's somebody who runs and supervises all the other workers that are here for this shift. I've been here for 5 years, and it's usually people who've been here for a while usually end up in this position sort of because they have experience and they say, oh, this is what we do with the cheese, this is what we do with the nuts and fruits and stuff. Yeah.
So what's it like coordinating a group of members/workers?
Every so often you get a worker who's a lemon, but working hard and caring about what you do seems to be fairly contagious, and for the most part I've not had any problems in the 5 years that I've been here.
William Houston works in food processing.
Which means as the different products come in, we weigh them, cut them, price them, and actually place them on the shelves for other co-op members. Anyone who wants to come in to actually serve and do the work. Anyone who can have 2 feet and 2 hands can come in and do the work.
When I started working here, and I, you know, for the first 6 months, you make a lot of mistakes. And I was feeling really bad about it. So I was talking to Marty about it, and he said, let me tell you a story. I was going down aisle 3 with 2 fully loaded U-boats, pushing one so that it pushed the other one like a train, ka-ching, 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 down the aisle. And at that time, we had an end cap with a bookshelf on it. The first U-boat caught the lip of the bookshelf. He rammed with the top of his face into the top of the U-boat and ricocheted off the first U-boat. But his weight hit that first U-boat and kept it going so that it dislodged the whole bookshelf, which caved down this way and hit the back door to the backyard, hit the emergency bar so the door flew open, and all the books went flying out to the backyard and it was pouring rain outside. So he said, don't worry about making mistakes.
You're listening to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly radio program bringing you local productions of national interest.
My name is Sam Withrow, and I've been at the co-op about 9 months, I suppose. I just moved here, and some friends of mine were members, so they got me into it. I think if you miss a shift, you have to do 2 makeups, and I think that completely makes sense. I've been in a few different other co-ops And if you don't have a good disciplinary system, everything just falls apart.
One of the days we visited the Park Slope Food Co-op, Lisa Caswell was working a makeup.
I've talked to a lot of people on the way home who think that the makeup system is ridiculous, and I get it. They're like, I inconvenienced people on my shift, and there was nobody to do my job. So I don't feel like it's unreasonable. Like, if there was no two makeup rule, like, would anyone ever work the shift?
Co-op member Din Clark.
I always tell people the same thing, because when people know I'm from the co-op, you know, it's almost like guaranteed they're going to go into the work aspect of it. And I said, it's 2 3/4 hours every 4 weeks. This is not like, you know, breaking rocks on the side of a highway in 90 degree weather. If you can't do 2 3/4 hours, then don't do it. No one is forcing you to join the co-op.
We're all put on this earth for a certain amount of time.
Joe Holtz.
And we're asking for your time. It's kind of outrageous that we would ask that. We demand it. We don't really demand it. You could just not be a member. We're willing to say, you know, if it doesn't work for you, don't be a member.
But there is a paid staff. About 25% of the work is done by staff. Dewanika Ford is an office coordinator at the Park Slope Food Co-op.
Everybody here are co-owners. They own the co-op, and it's their business to run. I just happen to be one of the paid staff members that helps to keep that administered. I've been a paid staff member for about 4 years. I've been a member for about 17 years.
Denny, a floor coordinator, has worked with some interesting members over the years. The owner of Terra Chips, a physicist who was also a stockbroker, multimillionaires.
Folks who actually make this place their shopping home is incredible. And it was weird at first for me working here. Like, giving doctors orders, you know, lawyers and doctors and physicists. Well, sir, you're going to move this box there, and it was a little strange at first, but you get accustomed to it.
Member Elizabeth Poole.
There are those who say that we're not a true democracy because the coordinators do have power. But you know, the way I look at it is that when you have over 500 people in any organization, there has to be some kind of control. There just has to be. Otherwise, chaos ensues.
And maintaining order enables the Park Slope Food Co-op to offer something unique. Receiving coordinator Leah Paul.
I don't think that being able to eat, you know, good quality food should be only for people who can afford it. You know, in a city like New York, where there is a lot of classism, this is kind of something that everyone can be a part of.
Part of the politics of food is being welcoming to people whose incomes may not be high enough to spend a huge amount of money.
So what is the politics of food? It's paying attention to the production and distribution of food, making sure the farming practices used to raise vegetables and meat do not damage the environment, exploit workers, mistreat animals, among other criteria. Stores make a point of informing their customers about the origins of the food they offer, and they focus on being environmentally responsible. The politics of food is a big part of the food co-op movement.
We have a shelf labeling committee that makes sure that there are signs that tell us, hey, you may be buying this conventional product or, you know, product that may contain genetically modified food in it.
A practice in Europe for several years now. There's also a fair trade committee that seeks out fair trade products. In fact, all the coffee is organic fair trade.
We have a huge amount of fair trade chocolate, which is very popular. And so we're very aware of these issues here.
In the 1980s, members were finding out about chemicals that were illegal in the U.S., but were being shipped to other countries and used on produce that was then imported back into the U.S.
So people said, I want to know the country of origin, so I could decide if I want to buy stuff from that country.
General Coordinator Joe Holtz.
Well, we did that, and it's about to become the law of the land. But we've been doing it for over 20 years. Well, why is that? It's democracy. It's listening to your members.
Environmental stewardship is another important aspect of food politics, and the Park Slope Food Co-op is an exceptional environmental steward. From the beginning, they donated leftover food to a neighborhood soup kitchen. In the early 80s, they began composting food scraps at a local community garden down the street. Recently, the co-op membership voted to eliminate plastic shopping bags and bottled water.
We're sort of like the Supreme Court as consciousness of the nation and the members change, the, you know, decisions change about what we carry and don't carry.
The first known co-op was started by Ben Franklin in Philadelphia, but the first food co-op was started in England around 1844 in Rochdale, England. During the Depression, a wave of co-ops formed.
And then the wave that started in the late 60s, early 70s was known as the New Wave. And hundreds of co-ops started.
Joe Holtz.
There were probably 20 or 25 co-ops in New York City. And they all had the basic idea that cooperation meant working together. But then something happened. A lot of the co-ops faded away.
And so in the mid-1970s, and in many parts of the country,
people started giving up on the idea that you should require labor in a co-op. But we never gave up on the idea.
Because the Park Slope Food Co-op is such a unique business model, it's often misunderstood, and that can lead to tension. Founder and general coordinator Joe Holtz.
Well, I was at a conference like in around circa 1980, and someone from New England said to me, "Oh, the Park Slope Food Co-op, oh, you're from that co-op that excludes people who don't want to work." So I said, "Yeah. And you're from a co-op that excludes people who can't afford the prices. So you could live with your exclusion, and we'll live with ours."
As the Park Slope founders and members see it, there are a few problems with the typical co-op model. Joe Holtz.
The co-ops that were started just so that people could have access to this good food, what if the access is no longer an issue? What if the food is now very accessible in their community?
When Park Slope and other co-ops started, access to high-quality, responsibly sourced health food was limited. Now, especially in large metropolitan areas, it's easier to find food the co-ops used to specialize in, and stores like Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, and even Walmart have organic options.
What if the co-op can't sell the food for as cheaply as the competitor? What are people going to do then? Are people going to still support the co-op if it doesn't make practical sense?
The Park Slope Food Co-op is business savvy.
The co-op is not a theoretical experiment. It's something that exists in the real world and has to deal with real world problems. We have to pay our bills on time so that people like selling food to us and be a good business for other businesses to do business with. But in the beginning, the word business was barely ever uttered.
Mike Aiken is a general coordinator at the Park Slope Food Co-op. He was the co-op's second employee after Joe Holtz. He came to the co-op with an MBA from Harvard and a very different lifestyle.
As a management consultant, I used to fly around the country first class and tell people how to run their businesses. Basically, when I decided that I'd had enough of the corporate world after a decade of the 60s, I searched around for alternative institutions. And I found various things, but they mostly didn't work. And this was the first sort of alternative institution I came across that actually functioned.
With Mike's background in business, he helped coordinate the co-op's first expansion in 1978. Then he set up its bookkeeping system. He also contributed a lot to the co-op's operational efficiency and managing its inventory.
So where your typical large food co-op might keep maybe 38, 39 cents out of every dollar of sales, we keep less than 17 cents of every dollar. And we're able to operate on that. So our margin is a little under 17%, which is fairly low for a conventional store.
Mike brought a really great sense of how to operate things.
Joe Holtz.
I was able to look at something and say, that's stupid. That's going to make us go out of business. Let's not do that. You know what I mean? But he could do that too. So we did it together.
I had always expected to retire, you know, when I got to 65 or something like that. But it turned out I really didn't want to retire that much. And so now I'm 75 and I'm working, I think, 72% of full time. It's perfect life.
It seems remarkable how obsessed the Park Slope Co-op is with sustainability. Not growth like other businesses, but sustainability. That means, for example, $30 million went through the door last year, and they ended it with less than nothing. Joe Holtz.
We ended the last fiscal year with minus $100,000. But our goal has been to give cheap prices to members and save as you shop and not have profits to distribute to anybody at the end of the year.
The key with the co-op, as with any business, is not to get distracted when important decisions have to be made.
It's the democracy, because I have to tell you, as an employee here and as someone who has to worry about the financial success of the co-op, not all the good ideas are going to come from me or from people like me, because I have to be a financial steward. And some of the things that our members have decided to do from a business point of view are a little scary.
And because every member is an owner,
it's more distracting because you have so many people pitching their ideas about the way it should go. And every idea is legitimate because it comes from a member owner. On the other hand, sometimes you learn great ideas that way. And that's beautiful. And the co-op is better for that openness and that transparency.
I'm Lisa Caswell. I've been a member of the co-op for about a year.
How do you like being a walker?
I like it now. I don't know how much I'm going to like it in February.
A walker is someone who goes with members to their home or car and returns with the shopping cart.
I just walked a mom and a daughter to their car where the 3-year-old talked my ear off the entire way there and then did not want me to leave.
The walker's work slot was created after members started blocking the neighboring fire station with their cars when they came to pick up their groceries. Now people who live or park within a 6-block radius can have a walker help them. But for the Park Slope Co-op, explosive membership growth has always been a problem. Joe Holtz.
I could say it's very frustrating, you know, because I've been dealing with this problem for forever. The Line Waiters Gazette.
The Line Waiters Gazette is a bi-weekly newsletter written by members.
And it was named that in 1975, and it was named that for a reason. It's because you could expect to wait online. We used to pass out the newsletter down the street. We open up more days, more shopping hours, more space. At the end of the day, which might take 5 years, you're too crowded.
Member and walker, Lisa Caswell.
It's definitely overcrowded a lot of the time. My boyfriend will not become a member because it's not worth it for him. I'm very picky about my food, so I try to come when it's not so crowded and deal with it.
There are just under 14,000 members utilizing the space.
We weren't thinking we'd be 1,200 members more today than we were last year, but we are. So if 1,500 people were to leave, what would happen? Probably 1,500 people will join.
Ellen Weinstadt.
It's not as intimate as it once was when it was, you know, originally it was one room once a week. You know, originally it was 22 people. So it's a little different. As the economy gets worse, there are more and more people who are looking for alternative economic models and people who are looking to co-ops as an economic model. And I'd love to see more of that. More cooperation, more community, instead of more competition and more capitalism.
People are living a lifestyle that's not sustainable.
Co-op member Ursula Rudenberg.
And I think until recently this was considered a progressive theory, and now all of a sudden, with the stock market crash, it's become a matter of fact. And one of the things people are asking is, what are alternatives? You know, how do we come up with real-life sustainable models, not just theories? And I think the co-op presents an example that is a demonstration of what an alternative can be.
Co-op member Din Clark.
The co-op's like my really good friend that, you know, you don't want to give up. And sometimes, you kind of need a little space and things aren't working out right now. I'm a little upset with you. And then you go off and you try to make new friends. And then you realize, I miss the old person. And you go back. And that's my relationship with the co-op. It's a pretty great place. And I'm glad that it exists. I'm glad that I found it. And I'm glad that I work there.
We know from the surveys we do of people who depart that often they move elsewhere, and the thing they miss most is the food co-op. And that's great. And I'm sorry there aren't others like it around the country, but you know, people are trying. And it's a hard thing to get something like this going, but it's wonderful if you succeed.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to We'll Work for Food. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. Production assistance came from Courtney Smith, Doug George, and Ursula Rudenberg in New York City. The music you heard was Election Day Serenade by Pops Muhammad, Looking for a Leader by Neil Young, Autre Mer by Charlie Hunter, Grage à Toi, and Flight by the Cinematic Orchestra. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio, thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. I'm Christine Black at Pacifica Radio in New York City.
And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio show is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.